This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivasuthi. It's our Doctor in the House segment. It's a Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with us. We have brought his competitor in today. I want to see
And we brought some rain as well.
Yes, I want to see you fight this out with your competitor today.
Okay, so if you really want to see a fight between gynecologists and urologists, then you have to tune in straight away.
She's just not a gynecologist. She is a urogynecologist.
Right, okay. That's right.
Get it right. The fire started already.
I had no idea that such a subspecialty actually existed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, welcome to the show, Dr. Kong Swee Yin. She is a urogynecologist from University of Malaya.
Thank you very much, Mira. It's my real pleasure to be here.
Yes, and I'm sure you were excited about coming in with George as well.
Absolutely. How could I resist this offer from you, you know, when I heard that Dr. George Lee was going to be in-house?
You've both worked together before, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. We were, tail end of me leaving UH, and then, you know, Suen was just coming around, and then, you know, we actually work on several capacities in meetings and things, so, you know, our work overlaps a lot.
For sure.
So this is what we're going to talk about today.
Correct. And that's what we want to discuss, the differences between a urologist as well as urogynecologist, because a lot of women also don't realize that you can actually go and see somebody like George for plumbing issues, right? Anything to do with your, you know, urinary tract system or, you know, those sort of issues, you can see George. But many people don't know that.
That's right.
Or urologists always associated with men's health in this country.
Indeed.
At least, in this country. So now there's someone called a urogynecologist.
Yes, that's
who
right, Mira.
Looks at plumbing issues in relation to women. Are you a urologist? Are you a gynecologist? We'll come back and find out from you. Our phone number to call us if you have a question is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Dr. Kong, how many of you are around? How many urogynecologists are there?
Well, it's still a very new specialty, especially in Malaysia. And I think at the last count, when we did a survey at the beginning of this year, there are probably about 17 of us in the whole of Malaysia. Mm-hmm. So that certainly is not enough. There are not enough urogynecologists to actually cover the work that we have in Malaysia.
Is it a new subspecialty in the world, though?
No, and certainly in the Western countries, it's been a subspecialty that's been around for quite a long while. Most of us are from a gynecology background, mm-hmm. who have taken an interest in urology. But there are certain countries also, like Japan, where, you know, urogynecologists were urologists before. So that's, in Malaysia, most of the urogynecologists are gynecology trained.
Okay. George, any interest to gynecology then?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this is a bit unfair. So I get to see all the men and then also get to see the women as well. But you get to see the women, you don't get to see the men.
Well, that's actually by choice.
That's right. So it is, life is a bit unfair when it comes to like that.
Okay, can you subspecialize in gynecology?
Yes, okay. Well, so we call it differently. We actually call it female urology. So, later on, I will just would like Suen to elaborate a little bit about the training to get to her position. In our position, if you have a urologist who, let's say, has specialist interest in female urology, then what you do is that you go through your urology training in the final 2 years, then you declare your subspecialty interest. Like, you know, Suen was absolutely right. In the UK, you have that super specialization, which in Malaysia, you know, we're all the jack of all trade, really. We have to do a lot of things. But the good thing about it is it's evolving. You know, early on, we had this opportunity to discuss. I mean, you know, if she's not really interested in obstetrics or cancer work, and obviously those are the areas that you really need to be super specialized to be good at, and then you can opt out of it and specialize in your area. Is that not true?
Yeah, I think I've been very lucky working at University Malaya, where it is a tertiary center, and we do have enough consultants within obstetrics and gynecology, and we have been lucky enough to actually subspecialize in our area of interest. So I have colleagues who purely do obstetrics with a special interest in fetal maternal medicine. And of course, I've also got colleagues who just do gynecology. So, for example, as George had mentioned, they There are gynecologists. There are also gynecologists who just do fertility work. So I think it's important, especially in a tertiary center where you are able to offer this subspecialty.
Interest, really.
Interest, yeah.
I mean, it has to be in a department where, you know, it works in harmony because, you know, if you watch Grey's Anatomy, you realize that when there's a, you know, overlaps in things, there'll be chaos in the hospital. But, you know, the good things about University of Malaya is that, you know, the urology and the urogynecologists, they all work in harmony. So it's absolute bliss.
Yeah, well, it is a rather unusual situation because actually, you know, I have worked in several hospitals, both in the UK and Australia.
And because you're
fighting for this. It's a well-known thing that urologists and urogynecologists tend to have this, they do not tend to get on.
Animosity.
That way because they see each other as, being on each other's territory. Mm-hmm. But I am in a very fortunate situation where I do actually get on and speak to my urology colleagues.
Okay. But so, why is that? I mean, I would have thought your area is really quite clear. It's female urology.
Well, I must actually just clarify that too because I actually still do a lot of gynecology. So maybe about 30% of my work is actually urogynecology, whereas the remaining 70% would be on general gynecology. So where so majority of my work would involve in urogynecology would involve say taking care of the woman who has urinary symptoms, for example incontinence, or you know recurrent urinary infections, for example, but also women who present with vaginal prolapses. So and it's not unusual that women present with both symptoms and conditions at the same time because there is a great overlap in terms of looking at risk factors for developing these symptoms.
Yeah, so for the interest of the listeners out there who want to involve in the conversation, essentially both of us deal with conditions such as recurrent urinary tract infections in women, prolapse, and also urinary incontinence. And those are the things that may interest you if you're listening.
But there are instances where you would refer a patient to someone like Dr. Kong?
This is the interesting part, actually.
Oh, you don't want to share.
No. The thing is that, you know, early on I was just saying that, you know, when I was at the Institute of Urology in London under the training of quite prominent female urologists, they say to me that this is a specialty where we are given patients, we're given that privilege by the gynecologist because naturally a woman will go and see a gynecologist first. So if they have take on the work, you very much will be workless. So this is a part where I actually have to kind of be very nice to my urogynecologist and please give me some work rather than take away work from them.
But how are women when they come and see you, George? Are they open to coming to see you when they have issues with incontinence or urinary tract infections?
Well, I mean, I said earlier on the three things that, you know, when I get patients who kind of waiting in the waiting room and suddenly women will get into the consultation room and then the men get really anxious and say, am I in the right place? Because,
yes.
You know, aren't you the male specialist, right? Okay. And then, you know, we deal with anything that touches urine, really. So essentially, when women come in, if they come to me, I would say the vast majority of them will probably go to gynecologists first. And then so if they have incontinence problems and then if they have got recurrent urinary tract infections or prolapse, then they will probably just assume that we will fix that plumbing work. So they will have very, very comfortable to talk about it. But I think to some degree when they want to talk about consequence of the operation, for example, when it comes to their sexual health and that sort of thing, then that might be a bit of issue because the vast majority of urologists are actually men.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Did you not consider doing female urology at all?
Well, this is what my boss told me before. It's like, you know, if they decide to cut the supply of the patients to you, they are done. That's it. No more patients. That's right.
I think certainly from the urogyny point of view, I think we can also address female issues, such as menopause, you know, women requesting for HRT, hormonal replacement therapy, for example, or for menstrual or, you know, symptoms or pelvic pain.
Yeah, and many urologists will find that quite uncomfortable.
So you could actually address all that. I mean, for someone like George, he's comfortable dealing with prolapse, but would that be right to say that not all urologists would be happy to
cope with that? So, in a way, the cross-referral is like this. So you might have a gynecologist who's not too happy to handle a situation of urinary incontinence which is something that we want to talk about later on, which is using a technique called tension-free vaginal tape, mm-hmm. which is kind of like a technique that is used for the prevention of urinary incontinence. And in this technique, predominantly is done by urologists. But when the urogynecologists learn how to do it, they themselves can take this on, and then the urologist will be quite jobless afterwards.
No. I think.
Don't be nice.
Well, you know, when would I actually refer a patient to the urologist like George?
Yes.
Well, I make many referrals, actually. And these would be women, say, for example, have got cancer of the urinary tract, say bladder cancer, kidney cancer, for example. If they've got stones, certainly these women I would, without a doubt, you know, mm-hmm. refer on, because those are conditions that I have not been trained to manage.
I see. Okay.
So I think at the end of the day, you know, I think we have to practice medicine the way that we have been trained and to be able to do that safely. And competently.
In a way, this is kind of like a shortcoming when it comes to medicine, because medicine, when it comes to specialist training, is trained per organ. Let's say urologist mm-hmm. is trained to deal with kidney stones and that sort of thing. But you don't really kind of treat patient in that holistic manner,
yes.
which sometimes can actually make it extremely difficult for patients, because, you know, a patient who come to see me for a recurring urinary tract infection may have, let's say, menopausal issues. And I will kind of say, well, you know, I deal with that. You know, you might have, let's say, fibroid. I don't think that's my area to infringe into. But yet, you know, Suyen might see a lady, let's say, has got kidney stone or bladder stone, will say, well, that's an area that I don't deal with, and you have to go and see a urologist. That might create some degree of inconvenience for patients.
Yeah.
So, and certainly, I think from the, you touched on the menopausal woman, mm-hmm. and certainly, I think we should not be fixated on just fixing the urinary issues, because some of these symptoms could actually arise from the menopausal state. And as a result, you know, it might not just be the dry vagina that is giving them discomfort when they're with their husbands. It might actually be, it may be that they have urinary incontinence when they are with their husbands. And mm-hmm. these are very embarrassing things that they may not necessarily talk to with their doctor. Mm-hmm. And of course, more so, the doctor does not bring this up in their, you know, consultation.
Yeah. I mean, in my observation, I find that whenever the problem, before they come too serious, because the gynecologists and urogynecologists always have that constant contact with patients, you know, from the start of period, pregnancy, and then menopause, you get that continuity of care. So before the problem becomes too serious, they probably will be dealt with by the gynecologists and urogynecologists. But when the problem becomes quite serious and they suffer quite significant impairment of quality of life, only then they come to see a urologist. I don't know whether you think that is a fair observation.
I think you're right there, because I think it is a myth to think that urinary symptoms and prolapse can only occur in the elderly women.
Mm.
And certainly these can arise even in young women, say during pregnancy, after delivery of their children.
And talking about vaginal prolapse,
yes,
or a pelvic
absolutely.
Organ prolapse?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And of course, I think as healthcare professionals, we should ask these questions, even though some may find it embarrassing to ask. But, you know, it is a very important question.
Indeed, and it's a lot more common than most people report it to be, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, so for the benefit of the listeners, perhaps you would like to elaborate a little bit by what do you mean by prolapse and how is it related to the, urinary incontinence?
Yes, we'll come back. Goodness, I had no idea all of this was linked, to be really, really honest. I was thinking of all of them in isolation, actually.
Yeah,
didn't
because,
realize that, you know, it could be a symptom of something else.
Yeah.
In the same area, right? But, you know, I want, also want to know, George, are you allowed to do an examination on a woman like a gynecologist would?
Well, actually, when it comes to doctors, all doctors are allowed to do, you know, even internal examinations, even though I am, I'm a penis doctor, right,
yes.
per se. But, you know, to examine the female genitalia, it's what I'm supposed to do because they're all interlinked. And then when the patient comes over, you have to do it. But whether you examine enough to make yourself good at it, to make the diagnosis, is that big question mark.
Okay. All right. We're trying to make that difference between who a urologist is and when do you see a urogynecologist. Dr. Kong Soo Yen, a urogynecologist from University of Malaya, in the studio with us, together with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. Come on, ladies, I'm sure you have a question because this is in relation to your part of the anatomy, and we're trying to find out how to efficiently diagnose and treat issues which are interrelated. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question, the number is 0377 109000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series. It's a Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio with us. And we have Dr. Kong Soo Yen, a urogynecologist, joining us today. We are trying to make the differentiation between what a urogynecologist does as well as what Dr. George Lee does as a urologist. There are plumbing issues, but Dr. Kong actually looks a little further as far as the woman is concerned. So does this mean, Dr. Kong, if you have a dropped uterus or a weak pelvic floor, we should come and see you? And is that all there is that you're concerned about as far as the woman is concerned?
Oh, no. Certainly, I think you need to address the other concerns. You know, yes, it might be just a vaginal lump, but how is it that it's affecting the woman? Is it, affecting her urinary symptoms? Some of them may have bowel symptoms as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, the vaginal lump may be so big that it's prolapsing out completely so that they may have problems walking even. And with it rubbing constantly on their underwear, for example, they may even complain of vaginal bleeding.
Mm.
Now, I must say, among the Malaysian women here, it may well be that the condition is really quite advanced before they present to a doctor.
Or they present quite late.
Yeah, maybe because of denial, or maybe I think it's more so embarrassment. It's not something you talk about with your friends and family. You know, so it's most of the time they will only mention to their dear ones, say their children, about the problem. For example, only when they say have problems urinating, opening their bowels, or having bleeding. Mm-hmm. And of course, for a lot of women, when they see blood, they worry about cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And
course.
Worse still, when they feel a lump down by the vagina,
prolapsing,
they worry that this is cancer.
Yeah.
So, and that's when they actually agree to see a doctor. So, of course, by then, we're talking about an advanced condition. And, of course, you need to address these issues. Another problem, of course, is the embarrassment, as I say. So it's not just not being able to talk to your family or to your doctor, but actually affecting the relationship, perhaps, with your husband, your spouse.
Yeah, I mean a lot of them kind of like have, it stopped them from doing what they usually do, right? I mean, it's like, you know, if prolapse or urinary incontinence can make your clothes smell and that sort of thing, it have a tremendous amount of impairment on their quality of life.
But symptoms would have presented even earlier, am I correct?
Not necessarily. That's the issue. I think some women may have quite advanced prolapse. They may feel a vaginal mass, lump down there, but they may actually have no urinary or bowel symptoms. Whereas another lady who may have, you know, mild to moderate prolapse may actually complain of pretty severe or urinary or bowel symptoms which are actually affecting the quality of their lives.
Shireen, how prevalent is this, and, you know, prolapse and urinary incontinence?
Prolapse
and
is,
also what are the risk factors?
Well, certainly prolapse itself is very common. I mean, if you're talking about a woman who's ever had any children, even if it's the one child, up to 50% of women
50?
Have been found to have a degree of prolapse, but thankfully, only about 10% of these women are actually symptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, a proportion of these would be symptomatic enough to seek medical attention. So we're talking about, you know, a vast proportion of women
yeah.
who, if you were to examine them routinely, would have a degree of prolapse.
So if you do your yearly appointment with your gynecologist, you probably find out.
Yeah, you would. But I think it's important also to find to point out that if you don't have symptoms, even if you do have a mild degree of prolapse, it doesn't mean that you need surgery. You really do not require surgery for that kind of prolapse.
Okay.
But it's obviously something that you need to keep an eye on. And I would certainly advise them against the any aggravating factors.
Such as?
Such as risk factors that anything that increases the pressure that you exert to that pelvic floor. For example, heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
And this could be occupational.
Mm-hmm.
It could even be, I suppose, even a housewife who does a lot of heavy laundry, you know, laundry baskets, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Or carrying heavy pots when they're gardening.
Putting on weight?
That putting on weight is a huge issue, especially, I would say this is an issue worldwide, you know, with growing obesity. Women or just any patients who, you know, have a chronic cough, for example, who who are heavy smokers, all this does not, you know, they do not
they make
help
things
with
worse.
The symptoms.
That's right.
Absolutely. These are all risk factors.
Okay.
And from the, if we go back to, say, for example, pregnancy and to the younger woman, obviously being obese actually increases your chances of developing diabetes in pregnancy too.
And diabetes itself probably is not too healthy, you know, doesn't make your pelvic floor too healthy.
Well, it's more so its effects on the unborn child.
That's gestational
diabetes. Gestational diabetes actually increases the chances of you having
a
large baby. And of course, a large baby, what we call macrosomia, can increase the chances of you having an instrumental delivery, a cesarean section, for example, and of course, trauma to the vagina during childbirth.
Mira is nodding away. There are all these things that women have to go through.
I've just realized that I can host any health show, but when it has to do with the woman's, you know.
What women have to put up with.
Yes.
Bennett,
it's very difficult, actually. I mean, I can talk about the man any day.
That's well, right, you know, yeah, and that's yeah, why yeah. women were designed to have babies.
That's
not
right. So we're tougher. Women are tougher to withstand the weather or these trauma.
And I haven't even come to the older woman because that's when a lot of issues surface.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. And certainly, yeah, with the onset of menopause and aging, with a growing aging population, I think problems with the pelvic floor, such as incontinence and prolapse, is only going to grow.
Yeah. All right. And then we're all living longer.
Absolutely. So we really have to be aware of all these problems, to detect them early, to make sure people are aware of these conditions, and hopefully present to the healthcare professionals.
I don't want to live long, George. I don't want to live long. I don't want to be like you. He wants to live up to 250.
Wow.
we'll come back to this discussion. But in what earlier on, you both mentioned that sometimes you disagree in your practice.
Yes.
In which areas?
Okay. All right. Okay. So in the overlaps, you know, in the areas, like, probably the easiest thing is like I will say is the who actually should be doing the operation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In fact, there are two operations. Early on, we talk about, you know, prolapse and also urinary incontinence. One of these kind of gold standards of the operation is corpal suspension or TVT. This is tension-free vaginal tape. And a lot of people probably will get excited and call call in. And then it's always this kind of like a disagreement as like who should be doing this operation. So during the conferences, you know, we have all these debates and they say who will do it better, who understand the pelvic floor better. It's of course all for the, you know, advancement of science. But in reality, we really need to draw that delineation. So one group of us probably feel that urologists know the urinary tract better. The other group of the urogynecologists will say, we know the women's pelvis better. So what do you think? What's your say?
Oh, come on, George. I think there's more than enough work for both of us to do. And certainly another 200 urogynecologists or urologists
especially early on,
the population of Malaysia.
Especially
I don't think that there should be a line drawn. That's I think it should be done by people who are well-trained, mm-hmm. who do enough of the procedures on a regular basis, mm-hmm. and who can do it safely and competently.
Well said. I think that is definitely...
It took the woman to put it all into perspective.
I rest my case. I'm sorry. I apologise on air.
Robotic surgery, George. I mean, you've spoken to us about Da Vinci and
how
you use that. Do you use robots in surgery as well?
No, I'm afraid I do not have the luxury at University of Malaya to play with
expensive
robot.
Toys.
But can Da Vinci do some work that
I do most of my vaginal surgery, well, through the vaginal roots, because it makes sense. That's where the problem lies and that's how you should tackle it. There's a lot of sort of words saying, you know, let's do natural orifice surgery. Well, I can't think of a better orifice to go through than the vagina.
It's a natural entry.
Certainly, I think rather than going down the roots of robotic surgery, there's certainly a place for laparoscopic surgery. That's keyhole surgery, which is really quite widely available now. So there are certain types of prolapse, the more complex prolapses, especially when a woman had prolapse surgery in the past and they're coming back with a recurrence, and that can occur.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, is the time when you may want to think about offering her, you know, prolapse surgery done in a different way. So, and it's important to be able to individualize the care for the patient in front of you to think of which is the best way to manage the problem now, as I said, especially for the complex patients. But I think from urology point of view, George, am I right? There is a big role in robotic surgery, especially when dealing with the prostates.
That's right. Well, in fact, Mira, interesting you pick robotic surgery as an example of, you know, how advanced technology can help in medicine. In fact, keyhole surgery actually was started by gynecologists first, and then that's why the rest of general surgery, urology actually take it on. And I think robotic surgery, it's very applicable in many countries to deal with complex pelvic surgery. It's because the robot itself have access to different area in the pelvis, which may be a bit narrow and a bit too difficult to gain access to.
But you're talking about the man.
Both, yeah. I mean, like, you know, the robotic surgery can be done on women as well, and then there are multiple reports of how the robotic surgery can even be done in a very complex, pelvic reconstruction.
Well, I sort of disagree with you there.
Sure.
Because, yes, there are gynecologists or urogynecologists using the robotic surgery for female pelvic floor reconstruction. But I think you could equally perform some of these surgeries laparoscopically.
Yes.
If you are a well-trained laparoscopic surgeon. So
I think that's a good point made, because, you know, just because robot is there doesn't mean that it will do it better. You know, if the laparoscopic, the keyhole surgery is doing better, it's creating the, you know, equal amount of efficacy and outcome in surgery and an ease of surgery, you know, many people would just use that.
Using robots, you need a skill as well to use.
Absolutely,
it,
right? And a lot of money, I must say.
Yes, a lot of money.
So I think when we are going to introduce a new toy, I think it's important that,
I've been put right second time.
That it has been shown to be advantageous and, you know, offering more benefits to the patient compared to the conventional laparoscopic surgery. Yeah. So I must say, from the female point of view, patient point of view, I don't think at the moment we have good enough evidence.
Evidence to make it a routine gold standard.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree
but
with
of course,
you on that,
yeah. If you've got the money, you've got a robot, and you are trained in it, why not?
See, now, this is government and private in the same room.
Yeah.
See, you have
you know,
the luxuries.
George has got millions, I think, to buy his robot.
At
so
his
he can
disposal.
Play with the toy.
Moving along with further questions.
See, when you have not enough money, you just make do with what you have,
right.
George.
Interestingly, you know, while we're on the subject of robots from one extreme to the other extreme, I mean, obviously, I don't want to scare those ladies who are driving in the, you know, the wet KL at the moment with torrential rain.
You're scaring me.
You're scaring you. Okay. But is it true for me to highlight that majority of women who've got prolapse or urinary incontinence don't really need an operation? Would you like to talk a little bit about pelvic floor exercise?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that
Kegels.
Up, George.
That's right.
Kegels.
That's right.
Kegels. Yeah. Well, you know, perhaps
before everyone started thinking that you need to have a robotic surgery, we're going to talk about Kegel exercise.
Prevention, especially that you have now spoken about how as we are all going to live longer.
Yeah.
Kegels, I think, is going to be crucial.
Absolutely.
We'll come back right after the market update and have that discussion. If you have a question for Dr. Kong Soo Yen, she's a urogynecologist, and Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, give us a call, 03-77-109-1000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We are discussing, I suppose, in detail, pelvic organ prolapses, such as vaginal prolapses, incontinence, a lot of which affects women. And Dr. Kong is actually, you know, shedding more light on how symptoms, how one condition can be the symptom of the other without us really realizing it. So that's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, and if you have just joined us, welcome. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio, together with Dr. Kong Soo Yen, a urogynecologist from University of Malaya. We are discussing the different roles between a urologist and a urogynecologist. Mm-hmm. I think we have spoken a lot about pelvic organ prolapses and vaginal prolapses and all of that. And as Dr. Kong mentioned earlier, we are all going to be living longer. We already are. These prolapses are actually going to probably be inevitable. Am I correct?
Well, I wouldn't say inevitable.
Please say no.
Well,
50%.
Well, no,
yeah, 50-50. No, that's right, yeah.
I think there's a lot we can do in terms of prevention. I think as for a start, we can learn how to do a Kegel exercise or pelvic floor exercise, learn how to tighten those muscles, pull up. Mm-hmm. And you don't necessarily have to wait until you're menopausal to learn how to do this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the difficult things my patient always faced is that, how do you do Kegel exercise properly? How do you advise people?
Till
to
this
do
day,
that?
I'm not sure if I'm doing it right. I don't even know if I'm feeling the right
thing. How do you describe
it? I think the best thing to actually try and it's basically what I normally tell patients is just imagine yourself sitting on the toilet. You're actually passing urine, and what is it that you squeeze to stop yourself in midstream?
Okay. Now we have the whole Klang Valley sitting in the car going,
squeezing away,
so squeeze,
away.
Squeeze, yeah. Squeeze.
And of course, you know, it's not easy to do. And I think if you are having problems actually doing this exercise or trying to get some reassurance that you're doing it correctly, it might be a good idea to pop down to your friendly GP or to your gynecologist or your urologist and ask them.
How will George? How will George?
Well, you know, you need.
Come on.
Well, I'm afraid you would require
some
to
instruments.
Have an instrument.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
you
we have
need
a device
to have a vaginal examination.
Just, no. You just don't put a finger there and
what?
See what is squeezed on.
But you know what? If I was to identify these women who need pelvic floor exercise, I would certainly refer them to the physiotherapist. And certainly we have very well-trained physiotherapists. And in fact, in University of Malaya, we have a team of them who specialize in, you know, for the pelvic floor. Just as you could have a physio specializing, I know, in a spine or in the hip, for example.
We just specialize in the pelvic floor.
Well, obviously, they are generalists. They do, you know, they can teach you physiotherapy for, you know, for the whole of the body. But there are some who would specialize
You know, has special interest for Kegel.
Kegel.
Well, because there are instruments that will give you biofeedback to see whether you're squeezing the right parts or not. Is that not true?
Yeah, and you know what? You could even buy some of these instruments over the net.
Okay. Yeah.
But earlier on you said about 50% of women will have some kind of a prolapse, even, you know, regardless of age. But why is that?
Well, you know,
were we not made?
You're robust, but not that
we
robust.
We were made to have babies. Why do 50% of us?
Understand that it is a rather tight fit to start off with for the baby's head to squeeze down the birth canal. And especially, as I mentioned, babies are getting bigger. Yeah. But the women's pelvis is not getting any bigger.
Yeah.
Add on risk factors like conditions like diabetes that then increases the size of the baby, this is going to be an issue.
Of course, you know, Malaysia being one of the fattest nations in Asia probably doesn't help, right?
Yeah, and we have shocking, you know, levels of diabetes in the population.
Why are babies getting bigger?
Why? Probably because the mummies are getting bigger.
Ah,
really?
Good point.
And of course, you know, as George has pointed out, you know, we live in a country that's full of carbs, you know, and that is a problem. Mm. I mean, we've talked about prolapse, but I must say also that urinary incontinence is actually very common too. And in fact,
in the younger woman.
No, you are wrong there, unfortunately. Mm. In the pregnant woman,
now I have to worry about incontinence
as well.
Up to a third, if not half, of women during pregnancy could have some urinary incontinence. We are talking about, you know, being heavily pregnant, and you know they having some leakage of urine when they cough and sneeze.
But isn't that quite normal because of the weight?
Well, it
is. And the pressure.
But having urinary incontinence during pregnancy and immediately after delivery has been shown to actually be an indicator of developing urinary incontinence in your later years.
Right.
So if you're actually having these symptoms in your younger years, it's best to start squeeze away.
While we're talking about squeezing, like how many squeezes do you need to do per day? How long do you need for? And how effective are the squeezes?
And you know what? I think this is when it's important to get your midwife or your doctor to show you how to do it.
Because you
could be doing it wrong. You could be wasting your time and all your effort. And worse still, with the wrong technique, actually causing more damage to that pelvic floor.
Really?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I've got patients when, you know, I've asked them during consultations and they've reassured me they've been squeezing away for years. But doctor, I still have this problem. So what do I do? When I examine them, I go, right, now show me how you squeeze.
Right.
And you know what? A lot of these women are doing it wrong.
Okay. All right.
And that is actually,
it's counterproductive, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's when it's important to actually check on their technique.
Yeah.
I mean, just because, you know, they say they've been doing it for years does not mean they've been doing it right.
So when you advise patients to do it, how often do they have to do it and how long for? And what is sort of effectiveness would you quote them?
Well, you know, this is long term. It's not a short-term solution. Just like I always tell them, it's like going to the gym, right? You need to carry on with this long-term. You may be able to tighten your muscles as you're doing the exercises for that 6 months or the year.
Mm.
But when you start getting lazy, because you've started to get some improvement, a lot of patients start to get lazy rather than doing it. Normally, we would say 2 or 3 sets per day if you can. And there are, you know, the regime, as you say, gets a bit complicated. You know, there are short squeezes, there are long squeezes because they're targeting different muscles. And of course, when you start slacking off and not doing it regularly, that's when muscles get weaker and lax again.
A lot of us go to the gym today. Is there anything we can do in the gym that will help?
Lose weight.
we'll lose weight, but to strengthen the pelvic floor muscle.
Is there anything in the gym?
Certainly, what I can tell you, losing weight certainly will help, but weightlifting will not help.
So to build those muscles, probably not a bad thing.
Yeah. So things like yoga, Pilates, I would strongly encourage because it does strengthen the core muscle, a core body muscle. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I think you still need to go for Kegel exercise or pelvic floor exercises because these target muscles which you otherwise would not be squeezing unless you were doing Kegel.
I mean, okay, we're talking about like surgery in one extreme and then we're talking about squeezing in the other extreme. I mean, is there something in between? Are there medicines available? We've got questions about, you know, are there medicines available to solve problems like this for women?
What?
To solve the weak pelvic floor. Because isn't that true that a while ago, for incontinence and then second, there was
always wants the easy way out.
That's right. Okay. Isn't that an easy way out or anything new in the market that might give women the easy way out? Wasn't there a medicine called duloxetine or something like that? Was that out on the market now because they don't work?
You know, duloxetine was, yes, you're right. It was a drug that was marketed to treat the stress incontinence. Mm-hmm. What I mean by stress incontinence is a leakage of urine when you
cough or sneeze,
etc. Okay. But I think due to it's got side effects.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the main reasons why it didn't really take off, and of course the cost as well.
Wow.
So I don't know. Do you have any experience using duloxetine?
Well, I think it was withdrawn from many countries, and then I actually haven't seen it for a long time. Mm. I think one of the biggest worries is that, you know, the side effects of association with suicide ideation
actually
got a lot of people quite worried.
Okay. Question from a listener: if one chooses to do a C-section, will they go through all these problems?
Good question.
Great question.
And certainly an elective, a planned cesarean section could reduce the risk of developing pelvic floor problems and certainly compared to having a vaginal delivery. But it is not 100% protective.
Mm.
Okay. So just being pregnant and carrying along a mass for 9 months does not actually help the pelvic floor because of that constant weight, the perhaps damage to the nerves that supply that pelvic floor. So just being pregnant itself has been shown to potentially cause pelvic floor damage. Now, an emergency cesarean section, of course, is not protective because if you have labored and more so, if you have had a caesar because you had obstructed labor, you could not deliver, you've been in labor for a long, long time. Those are all significant risk factors for causing damage to your pelvic floor.
Okay, another question here. When would it be necessary to see both the woman and her partner for consultation?
I think certainly women who are bothered with the implications to their sexual life, for example.
I think it's ideal to see couples together, but in reality, we don't really, do we?
We don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, the husband may feel, you know, that, you know, the wife has been saying no and pushing him away for other reasons.
I mean,
but it may just be something that could be not easily fixed, but could be discussed.
Because if whatever intervention that we do will have consequences on their intimacy, I really think it's ideal. I think that is a great question to say, when is it necessary? I think when it comes to consultations that you worry about or something that will perhaps impair your intimacy in later days, and I think it's important to come as a couple.
Okay. What is your biggest concern? What are your biggest concerns, Dr. Kong, as far as these issues are concerned? Incontinence, weak pelvic floor muscles. I mean, going forward, what are your biggest concerns for the women in this country?
I think it is the denial and maybe the lack of public awareness that something can be done. Something can be done, and more so, and it'll be probably more effective if they were to present early. I think don't hide away your symptoms. I think we should... They should bring this up when they see their doctors. They should perhaps mention it to their family that there is a problem, because it's such a personal thing, isn't it? But it does, negatively impact on the quality of life of patients, especially if you're incontinent. If you've got, walking around with a vaginal mass that's stopping you from doing your stopping you from urinating, from having your, you know, bowel motions, etc. I think it's very important they bring this up early rather than waiting to too late.
And when you see the mass, you're talking about the so-called lump.
Yes,
you're referring to that.
Prolapse lump.
And when you say that, you mean the vagina sort of
protruding out
from the vagina.
And actually, you know, the organ that can protrude out can be cystocele, like a bladder prolapsing, the uterus prolapsing, or can be the rectum prolapsing, or the everything prolapsing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Really?
That's right.
For the woman.
Yes,
everything could be out.
That's right. Okay, Mira is doing the squeezing now. Yeah, you can feel it.
And the thing is, you see, to the woman, it's just a lump, vaginal lump. But of course, it's important to have someone
to delineate, to find out.
And all of this is related to a weak pelvic floor.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just imagine that pelvic floor has been working hard, sustaining everything in right position for years and years and years. Suddenly, you know, it gives way for whatever things that you're doing.
And the treatment option would be to push it back up and sort of reinforce the pelvic floor. How do you do that?
I think if you've got pelvic floor problems, I think you could, I mean, to me, I would actually, when I assess a patient, as you say, see whether they've got any concurrence problems like urinary or bowel symptoms or sexual problems. And then to see how severe it is. As I say, if they're mild and they don't have any symptoms, you don't have to do anything about it. You can educate the woman about the importance of pelvic floor exercises and, of course, to avoid the risk factors. But of course, if they are presenting with a rather advanced condition, so things are hanging out, all right, it doesn't matter how much you squeeze, it's not going to work. So in those women, you could, rather than, you know, surgery is not the only answer, all right? You could opt to have a pessary, which is a device, a plastic device in the shape of a ring, for example, that you could insert into the vagina. Sounds awful, doesn't it? But, you know, it works. Okay. It works in a lot of women, and if it controls the symptoms well, and they are agreeable to being checked regularly by the doctor, say every few months, to make sure that there are no problems with the device, they could carry on using this for the rest of their lives. That's fine. But of course, there are certain women who have very advanced prolapse where, you know, no devices are going to work, no pelvic floor exercise is going to work, then we need to assess them properly and then counsel them as to whether they would want to proceed with surgery. And the type of surgery we offer them would, of course, depend on what the problem is. As George had said, there are many different types of prolapse. Okay. So,
yeah. Sure. Any developments that you're excited about very quickly?
Developments? Well, I would say in terms of research, we're certainly looking into what the problem is, how big this problem is in Malaysia. And in fact, in University of Malaya, we are looking at the more elderly population to try and identify the prevalence and the risk factors that affect our Malaysian population, both for women and men who do have urinary incontinence. So all the data we have so far have all been extrapolated by research done overseas.
Wow, good luck with the data collection.
We really need to get some local data.
Let us know when you have it.
Absolutely.
We would love to. George, your message.
Well, urogynecologist, 2 points. Urologist, 0 points.
George.
Squeeze.
I know. Kegels all the way,
ladies and gentlemen.
Squeeze away.
Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Kong Soo-yeon, urogynecologist from University of Malaya, and Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on The Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.